bana gelin.
A voice from the past. A distant memory. But whatever happened to Jimmy Clitheroe? Today, all that remains of the much-loved naughty Lancashire schoolboy is a very small brass plaque on the trunk of a cherry tree just by a rose garden in Carlton Cemetery near Blackpool, where his ashes were scattered amongst such other northern comedy greats as Norman Evans, Frank Randall, and Danny Ross. So what did happen? Well, the star of TV and radio died on the same day as his mother was buried. A cruel and bizarre turn of events. Well, to find out just what did happen, let's go back to the beginning. And taking up the story is Irene Oxford, Jimmy's cousin.
He was born in Clitheroe at number 58 Wilkins Street, now known as Highfield Road, but his parents lived in Blackow. So, of course, she came home to her mother's to have her baby. You didn't get to hospitals and things like they do nowadays. And then, of course, back to Blackow for his early years and his school years, right up to 14, when we left school. He left school in those days at 14.
He grew up in a small mill town, Blackow, just outside Nelson in Lancashire.
Stephen Poppett, researcher and co-author of the forthcoming book, The Jimmy Clitheroe Story.
And he seemed to be a normal little boy until he was about 7 or 8 years old. And then his parents realised that he wasn't growing up. He wasn't getting any taller.
And they took him to the doctors. Now, it was said that his thyroid gland was damaged at birth. And as thyroid gland controls your growth, I suppose way back in those days, the 1920s, which it was, they hadn't the advanced science that they have now to do anything about it. So he remained that size, because his father was 6'2". And Auntie Emma and my father, a brother and sister, they were quite small. They'd only be about 5'2", something like that.
The upshot was that he always remained looking as though he was about 11 years old, because he never grew taller than 4'3".
So, still far from his full height of 4'3", what could little Jimmy do? Stephen Poppett again.
Because his parents worked in the mill, and they were weavers in the Lancashire cotton mills, he couldn't do that because he wasn't tall enough to reach the looms in the mill. So he had to find something else to do. So he was doing quite well as a lad in amateur entertainments, in the Sunday school concert parties, and he decided that he would go into show business.
Stop climbing all over the settee. I'm trying to do my nails.
Ooh, it doesn't all pong, that paint you put on.
It isn't paint. It's nail varnish.
Why do you put it on?
Because it makes my nails look better. It covers the cracks.
Pity they don't make it for your face.
Ha, ha. Keep still. I'll have it all over my fingers.
Ooh, what a horrible colour. It looks as though your hands are dripping with blood. Dracula's daughter.
What do you know about nail varnish? You're too young to appreciate it.
Oh, am I?
Susan, that nail varnish is a bit vivid, isn't it?
Grandad, you're too young to appreciate it.
Don't be old-fashioned, Grandfather.
Well, it's a bit startling, isn't it?
That's what I told her. She looks like a vulture having a jambutty.
Just before Jimmy left school, he had a lucky break. He entered and won a local talent competition and got introduced to show business impresario George Baker, who ran what was then the Alhambra Theatre in Nelson.
He introduced Jimmy to a juvenile troupe called the Winstanley Babes, who came from Manchester. And by sheer chance, the week that Jimmy went to see him and said, "Can you help me to get into show business?" this troupe was appearing at the Alhambra. And so he pushed Jimmy into an audition with them. They accepted him, and straight away he was into show business.
Stephen's researching and writing partner, Sandra Skuse.
It's quite peculiar that they actually accepted him, because the Winstanley Babes were an all-girl troupe, so little Jimmy was the only boy. Oh, I think he did a bit of everything. He did a bit of dancing. I think there was a bit of skating involved as well.
He had this piano accordion. I mean, you've got to remember this, we're talking about little Jimmy Clitheroe. He's only 4'3" at his height, so to speak. He was a lot shorter when he was a child. And so he had a piano accordion that was 18 inches high. So it was half as high as he was, effectively. But that was what he did. He was a boy accordionist in variety.
And he did a little skating act at one time, roller skating. He joined a troupe of dancers and did acts with them. It was Winstanley's group, wasn't it? Yes. And he was with them for quite a while. And his little individual act was piano, accordion and xylophone. He was quite good with musical instruments, actually. He could play the piano, accordion, the xylophone and the clarinet.
So what happened to the piano accordion playing genius? Sandra Skuse again.
And story has it that he gave up the accordion because one night it fell on him on the stage and he couldn't get up. So he had to give it up and go and do something else.
Oh well, it was good whilst it lasted. Then, luckily for Jimmy, another break came along.
By chance, they had an engagement on the Isle of Man, and it was the same week as Old Mother Riley came there. And Old Mother Riley, Arthur Lucan and Kitty McShane, they were the biggest thing in show business in those days. And they sort of took Jimmy under their wing, and he went into a pantomime with them, and he made a film with them. And that was his big break, really, meeting Old Mother Riley.
So things were rolling along quite nicely, until another chance meeting some 5 years later. Jimmy was appearing in one of the theatres on Blackpool's South Pier, whilst Frank Randall was appearing in the other.
You'll have to excuse me.
Yes, there were two theatres on the South Pier in those days. Eventually, the pair got together with an act that had the audience gasping with amazement. Irene Oxford again.
Frank Randall would come on stage on his own, a few words to the audience, and then he'd say, well, I'll just get my old friend out here. And he'd go to a trunk and pick up Jimmy from the trunk, who was made up to look like a dummy, and just hung there, you know, put him on his knee and did the act, you know. And it was so lifelike. I remember seeing this for the very first time. It impressed me. And, of course, when it's all over, Jim comes to life and jumps off his knee. And the audience were absolutely amazed because it was so lifelike otherwise.
So, a good act? Some weren't so sure. Scriptwriter and radio producer Jim Casey.
Although it went well, I always found it rather grotesque. He looked too much like a dummy, you know, being a midget with this set grin on his face. I mean, it was very good, very lifelike, but he looked really like a dummy and it wasn't very nice, I didn't think, to look at.
So, of the radio career, Stephen Poppet.
Well, that began with James Casey. There was a very famous act on the music hall, Jimmy James. He did a stage drunk routine, and he was extremely good. And his son, James Casey, who originally wrote for his father on the stage, began to write for his father on radio. As a result of writing for his father on the radio, he became a BBC radio producer. While he'd been in Variety, he'd actually met Jimmy Clitheroe. So when he came to produce a Variety show on the radio called Call Boy, he wanted a boy to be the call boy of this fictitious Variety theatre.
Well, we sort of worked, or Jim Casey, who was writing it, worked a little story into Call Boy, where every week we used to do a little domestic scene in the show.
And it was very successful, and a little while afterwards, I did a pilot of The Clitheroe Kid. Everybody liked it, except the head of that programme, and he didn't want a midget on radio, he said. So I said, well, they don't actually know he is, you know, being radio, because he sounds like a boy. He said, yes, but I know, and I don't like it. So we did another two series of Call Boy, but the third one, I was in the BBC by then, and I produced it. And when we had the next meeting, I was waiting at the door, and I said, Call Boy figures, fantastic. He said, yes. I said, the best they've ever had. He said, yes. I said, the reason is Jimmy Clitheroe at home playing a little boy in a 7-minute sketch. Now can I do the Clitheroe Kid? And so in the end, he said, yes, do six.
We present Jimmy Clitheroe as the Clitheroe Kid, with Peter Sinclair's grandfather, Patricia Burke's mother, Diana Day as Susan, and Leonard Williams as Theodore Craythorpe in
Clitheroe and the Hound Dog.
And that's how the Clitheroe Kid got started. One day in 1953, Jimmy Clitheroe had been appearing on the same bill as James Casey and his father in a variety show, and decided to use him when he needed a little boy later on for a radio show.
Father! What on earth are you doing, playing marbles?
No, I'm looking for a mouse.
A mouse?
Aye, there's a moose loose around this goose.
Oliver, you mind that. You go downstairs and see if you can get a trap.
Look, it's Timothy, a tame white mouse.
Father, fancy bringing a thing like that into your room.
It's Jimmy's mouse. He got it from Morsi.
Jimmy, you'd no right to get that mouse without asking me. You know that Susan's terrified of them.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mum.
Well, hurry up now. Come on, let's see if we can find it.
Susan's found it.
The lover of furry creatures was Jimmy's radio sister, Diana Day.
He did and said things that we would probably all like to do ourselves, but couldn't get away with it, but he could.
He always wore the basic stage makeup and always wore the short trousers and the blazer and the school cap. Again, I think as a stage performer, he didn't feel he was working until he had these working clothes on. And he was a situation performer on the stage. You know, he could not work alone at all. In the whole of the run of the Clitheroe, as I say, what, 279 shows, he never, ever suggested a plot or, in fact, I don't think he ever changed a line.
Right, Mum, what is it you want?
Would you go and call Susan, please?
Certainly. What shall I call her? Fishface?
So, at last, Jimmy had hit the big time. But all that stardom meant a fair bit of travelling, as Cousin Irene Oxford remembers.
I drove him wherever he wanted to go, rather than... In fact, I taught him to drive eventually. On those long journeys from Oxford to Manchester, we'd change over occasionally. I put the L plates up and let him have a go. But that was because the carpenter at New Theatre in Oxford altered the car so that he could sit on it. We had wooden blocks put underneath the seats and wooden blocks put onto the pedals to extend them for him to be able to reach them. It was all done by the carpenter at the New Theatre, and of course, every time we stopped, we'd all these things to put on and and add to, and he'd get in and have a little drive, and he was absolutely thrilled to bits. And by the time we got back to Blackpool for the summer season, he passed his test. That's when he used to drive through Blackpool in his... Somebody said, there goes... I've forgotten what make of car it was now. There goes whatever it was, and there's nobody driving it.
Well, that car was a powder blue Mercedes. Co-writer of The Clitheroe Kid, Frank Roscoe, remembers one incident well.
I'm driving round this bend and up to the playhouse, and I'm turning in to go up the side of the playhouse to park. And as I turn around, I see, some distance behind, I see Jimmy's car. And behind Jimmy's car is a police car, and I thought, oh dear, here we go again. And I don't think Jimmy was even aware, you know. No. I don't think he'd looked. Anyway, he turned in and parked, and the police car parked behind him. Policeman took his time, as they do, and gradually got out and went, obviously, to sort out this lad who was had stolen a car or something. And only when he got there and looked at him did he realise who it was. And you feel so sorry for them because they look and they say... Oh, Mr. Clitheroe. I thought it was you. Yes. And they get the notebook out and say, would you mind, my kid would love your autograph, you know.
Well, yes, he was stopped by a policeman, thinking that he was pinching a car, you know, until they actually got up close. I mean, a police car once escorted him right into Manchester and then pulled up and said, right, out. And I've got, oh, we're very sorry. Those things did happen, it's quite true. I mean, was one night we were going through, I've forgotten where it was, Stoke somewhere, one of the cities, we were undoing a show, we were late, and the car was absolutely packed full with people. And Jim said, oh, I'll drive. And he got in, and we went down a one-way street. And the policeman stopped us, and he said, oh, are you licensed to drive this car? So I said, yes. So I said, right, fair enough. He said, in fact, we're late for the theatre. Oh, of course, he said. Right, stop. He stopped all the traffic coming down the one-way street and let us go out into the centre of the way in order to get there on time.
His boy-like appearance wasn't just noticed by the boys in blue. Sandra Skuse.
I think a lot of people who would stop him in the street would treat him as a kid because he was a kid. And I think Molly Sugden said sometimes it was very difficult to remember that he was an adult.
He was like a very small man. And I say man advisedly. But that was a funny thing. On stage or in television, he became a little boy. He was a little boy. I reacted to him as a little boy. In fact, one director once said to me, I'm so afraid one day you'll smack him.
It's always happening as soon as they hear the voice. They say, well, I know who that is. And then they say, Well, you're the same off as you are on, you know. You talk the same off as you do on.
In show business, of course, he wasn't a midget. He was Jimmy Clitheroe, who was a comic. And therefore, people would treat him as an ordinary man. It was just as easy for them to say he was good or he was lousy without feeling any sort of guilt. Because outside, people would think of him possibly as a, oh, look, there's a little man, a midget. But in show business, of course, he was Jimmy Clitheroe the comic.
I'm sorry I kept you waiting, Alfie, but I really wanted that bath.
I've been telling you that for a week.
Don't be so cheeky.
That's enough of that, Jimmy. Sit down, Susan, I'll get you a cup of tea. Is Grandad ready yet?
Yes, he's coming down now, Mother.
Hey, what are you putting the light on for? It's still daylight.
Because I want to look at my face in the mirror.
There's bravery for you, Alfie.
Oh, that bathroom mirror. My lipstick's all crooked.
Nah, it looks all right to me.
Of course your lipstick's all right. It's a face that's crooked.
The BBC had thought about putting the Clitheroe Kid on the TV, but it never materialised. Meanwhile, Ronnie Taylor, who had produced Callboy, had moved to ABC Television, then part of Granada, and he wrote the 1963 TV series That's My Boy, starring Derek Guiler and Jim Monkhouse. Then, between 1964 and 68, the TV series for which Jimmy is best remembered, 49 episodes of Just Jimmy, which starred Danny Ross and Molly Sugden. So what happened to the television work? Sandra Skuse.
Towards the end of his life, he was actually beginning to look older. He had kept his young looks for years and years, and unfortunately, by the time he got to television, it was just beginning to show that he wasn't an 11-year-old schoolboy. And so it was sad in a way that if TV had got to him earlier, things might have gone a different way.
Television works in close-ups.
TV director Geoffrey Wheeler.
An act like Jimmy Clitheroe is fine on the stage because everybody is at least 25 yards away from you, especially in the old days when you had footlights in the orchestra pit. So quite distant, so makeup and costume and so on, you could create the illusion. If you're standing so near to them that they're, you know, you can touch them, then it's difficult to maintain that illusion, and it is a little bit strange. And perhaps it isn't enormously wise, if you have that kind of an act, to do it in big close-up.
By the time the TV career had dried up, Jimmy had bought a house in Bispham Road, Blackpool. But still following, faithfully behind, was his ever-clinging mother, Emma.
Well, he absolutely adored his mother, really, didn't he? I mean, he wouldn't have done anything. And really, I think his mother always sort of told him that he was, you know, a bit of a freak of nature.
Diana Day.
He was always such a careful person with his money and everything, you know? Because I think his mother instilled it that he had to be.
Right, don't bother to bring any money. I'll borrow some off me grandad.
So, with his mother in tow, they toured the theatres. Not residing in hotels, but in a caravan, which Jimmy had bought because, so rumour has it, he was too tight to pay for hotel accommodation. That wasn't the only tale of his miserly ways, as longtime friend and business partner Tommy Trafford tells.
We went to buy a hotel, which he was keen to have. And anyway, I knocked him down from 17,000 to 10,000. And he says, "You've done right well for me today. Don't you worry. I'll see you right." And he bought me a 20 packet of fags.
Now, to be fair to Jimmy, he did occasionally spend money, usually at his favourite pastime of gambling, on the dogs and on the horses.
He was very, very interested in horse racing. He had his own horse.
He went on to buy two betting shops. But did this big-shot lifestyle help to pull the birds?
If a friendship grew between him and any of the young ladies in the shows or the cast, his mother would not be at all appreciative and used to say, you know, "I don't know what you're bothering about with my son for, and with all the rest of it. It's not in your ear, and he's not this and he's not that," until in the end she embarrassed them so much that they would think, "Oh, well, you know, I can't do with this." Because I can remember there was one occasion when it was, you probably don't remember, the Dagenham Girl Pipers, but there was a very nice young lady that was not much taller than Jim himself, really, but mother put a stop to that.
That was until one special girl came along. as Jimmy's next-door neighbour, Irene Roberts, remembers.
You see, he had that girl, you know, Sally, did you know that? She was nicely made. She was tall and slim and smart.
She was very attractive, very tall, very leggy-looking girl, exactly the sort of girl you might expect to have been a Tiller girl. You can see why he was attracted to her.
So he met Sally in pantomime at Leeds, and they struck up a relationship. She was very good for him in many ways, but, I mean, she milked him also for things she wanted. But she was a companion for him.
And what did Mother make of Jimmy's newfound love?
She found out that she was wasting her time. She was getting nowhere, so she had to accept the fact or accept defeat and back out. But she didn't, so, of course, they went as a threesome everywhere together. Then she had to accept Sally.
Ah, at last, a proper girlfriend. Wasn't she?
I shouldn't think so. Well, I mean, if we want to go into it sex-wise, nothing could have happened, really. But, yes, in other ways, yes, she kept him company wherever he went and went as his lady friend, officially. But it would be in name only, I should think.
And then, just when things were starting to look up in the relationship department, disaster struck.
Oh, it was terribly sad. She died in a car crash.
At the time, we were having alterations done to Sawley Brow, out at Sawley, the hill, and the road workers were all there. And she was driving along towards the bottom of the hill, and she came across another car that she tried to overtake, and she ran right into the back of a lorry with girders on. And she wasn't dead immediately. She was taken to Clither Hospital, but she died within half an hour or so. And he found himself then just left with his mother, no one else.
Jimmy never really recovered from the loss of Sally. Added to this, the radio series had been cancelled. And Emma, his mother, now in her 80s, was becoming frail. Eventually, she died on the 1st of June, 1973. A funeral was to be on the 6th of June. Irene Oxford takes up the story.
I'd been over to be with him and make arrangements for the funeral shortly after Auntie Emma was brought to the parlour, funeral parlour. It was just up the road from where they lived. And we made arrangements for the funeral. Then I said I'd had to go back home to Skipton to my children and whatever. And so his uncle from London came up, uncle and wife, to stay with him in the bungalow until the funeral. And I didn't hear another thing until we arrived, walking up the drive for the day of the funeral, and his uncle from the south said, Jim's not here, Andy. They've had to take him into hospital. And I said, why? What's happened, you know? Well, I think he mixed sleeping pills and drink last night, and they found him unconscious this morning. So I said, oh, grief. So, of course, I dashed off in the car and up to the hospital. And I said, has anybody been up yet? They said, no, because we've been trying to deal with things here and the funeral and everything else. So I said, right, I'll go up. But when I got there, of course, I was informed that he died.
So was it an accident or was it suicide? Jim Casey.
I don't know, but I don't think so. I think he just took sleeping tablets and then he drinks. And I mean, he was very depressed and terribly, terribly shattered with his mother's death, and probably drank quite a bit and then took more tablets without realising it, I think.
He'd always had his mum around. He'd always had the radio series for the previous 15 years. And he'd had Sally around for a long time. And all those three things that were so important to him in life had suddenly gone. So he must have been confused, depressed.
But I can understand that life would have been very bleak for him without his mother, because she was the most important thing in his life.
And the coroner therefore decided that this was just an accident. Nobody believes that Jimmy had enough strength of mind to actually decide to kill himself. People just say it's ridiculous. He would never have done that deliberately. He was too much of a coward to have done that.
So, of course, we'd announce to everybody that on the day we buried his mother, so Jim had died in hospital.
The eternal naughty Lancashire schoolboy's life came to an abrupt end at the age of 51. But was it a happy life? Next-door neighbour, Irene Roberts.
And he'd always had his mother there everywhere they went. His mother was there. He had a rotten life, really, I should say. And he says, do you know, Irene, I feel awful. I said, do you? He said, yes, and when I get on that stage and the curtain goes up and the orchestra starts, I come alive. I forget everything else and I live it.
He his ashes and I think those of his mother's were scattered in one of the rose gardens at the Carlton Cemetery. And just outside the entrance to the rose garden, there is a cherry tree with a tiny little plaque on it for Jimmy and his mum.
Those involved with the Clitheroe Kid this week were Peter Sinclair as grandfather, Patricia Burke as mother, Danny Ross as Alfie Hall, and Diana Day as Susan. The recorded programme was written by James Casey and Frank Roscoe, produced by James Casey, and starred Jimmy Clitheroe as the kid himself.
Isn't it marvellous, eh? A programme all about me. I've really enjoyed telling you all these stories. And you might be interested to know that, up to date, I've had 34 spankings, washed my neck 6 times, and eaten 500 weight of whipped cream walnuts. See you next week. Ta-da!